Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Susan Shand, John Russell, and Steve Ember. But first, this report from Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Every culture has some sort of person-to-person greeting, but they are different all over the world. In some countries, such as the United States, handshakes and hugs are the norm. In many European cultures, kisses on the cheek, or air kisses, are the thing to do when greeting people. And if you play on a sports team, high fives may be the greeting, no matter what your cultural background. These are our traditions during normal times. The World Health Organization recently declared the new coronavirus a pandemic. Health officials all over the world are urging people to wash their hands frequently. People are warned to avoid large crowds and to practice social distancing to control the spread of the disease. This has led to new ways of greetings around the world. The new COVID-19 virus came from Wuhan, China. So it is not surprising that a video featuring something called the Wuhan Shake recently went viral. In the video, a man offers his hand to another man for a handshake. Instead of shaking hands, the two men greet each other by kicking feet. Quick right kick, quick left kick. The video then shows more men greeting each other this way. It looks like a dance step or a soccer move. Other videos are appearing on social media showing people in other parts of the world using the foot tap as a greeting. Zheng Yuwen is a television host for Voice of America's China service. Her job involves contact with many on-air guests. So she says she has changed her guest greeting policy.
So starting today, I was telling all my guests who appear in the studio, we don't shake hands anymore. We do elbow touch, we do, foot tapping, or we say foot kissing, you know.
Another journalist in VOA's China branch, Sharon Wu, is taking a different approach. For now, she has not changed the way she greets guests. However, she has a new after-greeting habit, group hand-washing.
Recently, we have some guests coming to the studio, and for me, I still shake hands with them, but after that, I say, okay, let's both go to the restroom and wash hands.
Mir Abdul Mushref works at Voice of America in the Afghan service. He says that while hugging between men and women is not common, same-sex hugging is. However, those who used to hug have started using new ways of greeting people.
Usually, people are not shaking hands, but they are greeting verbally. They are not hugging, which is common among Afghans here in my service. We are just elbow touching, and sometimes we are kicking feet to each other, and sometimes we are just, heading bump bump to each other.
In Iran, people have used a similar greeting called butt bump. Besides the foot kick, butt bump, and elbow touch, there are other ways to greet people without touching. Many Asian cultures already use non-contact greetings. So people in this part of the world may have an easier time avoiding person-to-person contact. In Japan, a deep bow with both hands kept down to the sides is a traditional greeting. In Europe, kissing is a common way to greet people. People in France and other parts of Europe often use two kisses, one on each cheek, or in the air, as a greeting. People in Switzerland give three kisses. Reuters reported that health officials in Switzerland and France have advised people to stop the traditional kiss greeting. And the Italian government has banned kissing in an effort to stop the spread of the disease. This is not the first time a government has made lip contact between people forbidden. In 1439, kissing was temporarily banned in England during ceremonies involving King Henry VI. This was to avoid endangering the king's life during the plague. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Sixty years have passed since American Rosalyn Pope came home from Europe to the southern United States. At the time, parts of the South still enforced segregation of the races. Blacks were required to live separately from whites. Concerned about injustice and angry, Pope sat down and wrote a document that became an appeal for human rights. It was published on March 9, 1960. It announced the formation of the Atlanta Student Movement, whose campaign of civil disobedience helped end racist laws and policies across the South. After all this time, Rosalyn Pope is still deeply worried that the rights she and others fought for are slowly disappearing. We have to be careful. It's not as if we can rest and think that all is well, she told the Associated Press last week. The appeal quickly became a civil rights call to action after it appeared as a full-page advertisement in Atlanta's newspapers. It was denounced by Georgia's then-governor, Ernest Vandiver. However, Pope's appeal was celebrated in many other areas. The New York Times and the Los Angeles Times reprinted it. It also was entered into the Congressional Record, the official record of the U.S. Congress. The idea was to explain why black students would not listen to their parents, professors, and police who urged them to end segregation through the political system. The students decided to take action. The appeal denounced the racist laws that controlled education, jobs, housing, voting, and law enforcement. It called on all people of goodwill to work to end segregation. We do not intend to wait for those rights which are already legally and morally ours to be meted out to us one at a time, it said. The time has come for the people of Atlanta and Georgia to take a good look at what is really happening in this country and to stop believing those who tell us that everything is fine and equal, it said. The students persuaded Atlanta's black families to boycott segregated stores and theaters. It told them to repeatedly seek service in places where black people were not permitted. After many acts of nonviolent protest, hundreds of students were arrested throughout that spring and summer. Pope wrote the Atlantic Student Movement's appeal as a 21-year-old student body president at Spelman College. Born and raised in Atlanta, Pope said she did not know how it felt to be free until she was 20, when she spent a year in Europe on a Merrill scholarship. There were no places I couldn't go, no programs I couldn't take advantage of, no limits to my existence. I could eat where I wanted. I couldn't do that in Atlanta, she said. I felt like the shackles had been taken off me. When she returned to the United States, I was so miserable. I just didn't know how I was going to stand it, she said. Pope said she was drinking coffee with Julian Bond, who would later become a leader of the civil rights movement, when they learned about a sit-in in North Carolina. During the protest, black students would enter an all-white restaurant and refuse to leave. Why aren't we doing that? Bond and Pope asked themselves. We decided to start a movement, Pope recalled. College officials asked Pope, Bond, and other students to write a public document explaining their decision to act. Pope wrote it herself, while Julian Bond used a typewriter to put her words to paper. Their campaign of boycotts and sit-ins forced white leaders to desegregate stores, theaters, and schools. I'm Susan Shand.
Hip-hop is getting its very own museum in its birthplace in New York State. Hip-hop is the name for the music, dance, and fashion culture that developed around 50 years ago in the New York City borough of the Bronx. The permanent home of the Universal Hip-Hop Museum, set to open in 2023, celebrates the culture's history. For now, a small pop-up exhibit shows what visitors can expect. Rocky Bucano is the museum's executive director. He noted that, until now, there isn't a physical place that is dedicated to the preservation and celebration of hip-hop history and culture. Bucano told the Reuters news agency that the museum started as an idea about 8 years ago. Rappers Curtis Blow, Afrika Bambaataa, and Grandmaster Melly Mel wanted to make sure that the stories can be told accurately by the people who created the history themselves, Bucano said. Other performers have since become partners in the project. They include Nas, Ice-T, and LL Cool J. Hip-hop was born in the South Bronx in the 1970s. The dancing, rapping, and DJing parts of hip-hop grew out of the difficult inner-city environment. Hip-hop has since developed into part of popular culture. The new exhibit tells about the early days of hip-hop. The exhibit will be replaced every 6 months with the next period in the culture's development. When the museum is complete, the 5,570-square-meter space will have interactive exhibits, live shows, film screenings, and conferences. One room will have a Breakbeat Narratives interactive console. The device was created with Microsoft Corporation and the MIT Center for Advanced Virtuality. It takes visitors on a hip-hop history trip based on their reactions to different characters in a game. It forms a custom narrative of hip-hop history based on their musical preferences, Bucano said. The exhibit will include Curtis Blow's original beatbox machine and the first and second rap records ever released. The grand opening, in 2023, is planned to mark 50 years of hip-hop. Work on the project will begin in July. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The United States entered the Second World War in December of 1941. Europe had already been at war since 1939, but the United States did not enter World War II until Japanese forces attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The attack was a surprise, but American military and political leaders had believed that the United States, sooner or later, would be pulled into the fighting, and they began to prepare for war. President Franklin Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy under President Woodrow Wilson during World War I. He remembered how American troops were not ready for that war. Now that he was president, Roosevelt wanted to be sure that the United States would be ready when it had to fight. Throughout 1941, Roosevelt urged American industries to produce more weapons and other military supplies. He established new government agencies to work with industry to increase arms production. Some business leaders resisted Roosevelt's efforts. They felt there was no need to produce more arms while the United States was still at peace. But many others cooperated, and by the time Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, the American economy was producing millions of guns and other weapons. Still, this was not enough to fight a war. After the Japanese attack, Roosevelt increased his demands on American industry. He called for 60,000 warplanes, 45,000 tanks, and 20,000 anti-aircraft guns. And he wanted all these within 1 year. A month after the Pearl Harbor raid, Roosevelt organized a special committee to direct military production. He created another group to help companies find men and women for defense work. And he established a new office where the nation's best scientists and engineers could work together to design new weapons. These new government organizations faced several problems. Sometimes factories produced too much of one product and not enough of another. Sometimes tools broke, and some business owners refused to accept government orders. But the weapons were produced, and American troops soon had the guns and supplies they needed. The federal government had to quickly expand its own workforce to meet war needs. Federal spending increased from $6 billion in 1940 to $89 billion in 1944. That was 15 times as much spending in just 5 years. Roosevelt had to take strong steps to get the money for all this spending. He put limits on wages. He increased income taxes to as much as 94% on portions of incomes over $200,000. And he asked the American people to lend money to the federal government. The people answered by purchasing almost $100 billion in war bonds. The great increase in public spending raised the threat of high inflation. Roosevelt created a special office with the power to control prices. Many Americans agreed with the idea of price controls, but every business wanted somebody else's prices controlled, not their own. Federal officials had to work hard to keep prices and supplies under control. They restricted how much meat, fuel, and other goods people could buy. The price control program generally worked. Its success kept the American economy strong to support the troops fighting in Europe and Asia. One reason these strong economic steps worked was because most of the American people fully supported the war effort.
She's the part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie, the riveter, keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage. Sitting up there on the fuselage, that little friend can do more than a myth can do. Rosie, the riveter, Rosie's got a boyfriend, Charlie. Charlie, he's a Marine. Rosie is protecting Charlie, working overtime on the riveting machine. When they gave her a production lead, she was as proud as a girl could be. There's something true about red, white, and blue about Rosie, the riveter.
You can look at photographs of people from those times and see in their faces how strongly they felt. In one picture from the state of North Carolina, a group of men are standing in front of old rubber tires. They are planning to give the tires to the Army to be fixed and used for military vehicles. Another photo shows a woman visiting a hospital. She is singing to a soldier to lift his spirits. Still another photo shows a man who owns a small food store. He is placing signs on meat and cans of food to tell people how much they are allowed to buy. You can also get an idea about the feelings of the times by the names of some of the popular songs during World War II. In addition to Rosie the Riveter, there were songs like Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. One of the most hopeful songs was this one, recorded by Britain's Vera Lynn. All Americans supported the war. A small number refused to fight because of religious or moral beliefs. They were known as conscientious objectors. And some Americans supported Adolf Hitler and other fascists. But almost everyone else wanted to win the war quickly and return to a normal life. Many Japanese Americans served with honor in the United States Armed Forces. But many Americans were suspicious of anyone whose family had come from Japan. They refused to trust even Japanese American families who had lived in the United States for more than a century. Many banks refused to lend money to Japanese Americans. Many stores would not sell to them. The federal government relocated thousands of Japanese Americans in California and other states into internment camps. They were released only after the war ended. It was many years before the government officially apologized for mistreating Japanese Americans. But World War II did lead to progress for another group that was often the target of discrimination, Black Americans. Black leaders spoke out. They said it was unfair to fight a war for freedom in Europe while Black Americans did not have all the same freedoms as white citizens.
Negroes want the same things that white citizens possess. All of their rights, and no force under the sun can stem and block and stop this civil rights revolution which is now underway.
In 1941, a leader in the Black community, A. Philip Randolph, threatened to lead a giant march on Washington for civil rights for Blacks. President Roosevelt reacted by issuing an order that made it a crime to deny Blacks a chance for jobs in defense industries. He also ordered the armed forces to change some of their rules that discriminated against Black service members. Blacks made progress in the military and defense industries, but most other industries still refused to give them an equal chance. Major progress on civil rights would not come until the 1950s and 60s. Life was busy during the war years. There were many changes in the economy, business, music, race relations, and other areas. But in many ways, life continued as it always does. Americans did what they could during the hard years of World War II to keep life on the home front as normal as possible. But almost everyone understood that the first job was to support the troops overseas and win the war. This strength of purpose at home gave American soldiers the support they needed, and it also helped President Roosevelt as he negotiated with other world leaders. Diplomacy and foreign relations became much more complex during the war.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.